The single biggest threat, as I would see it, to our success over the next 5 years is execution risk, as I call it. Can we execute on the plans we have around housing, water, grid, renewable energy? These are societal issues as well as economic issues.
Hello again and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest in this episode is a man of many talents. He's an accountant and a corporate tax expert. He's the former managing partner of PwC. He's also a published author and the current chairperson of the IDA. He's also the eldest son of the former minister and TD, the much admired and late Mary O'Rourke, Fergal O'Rourke. You're very welcome to the Insights podcast.
Thanks, Sean.
You've captured a lot of headlines in your own professional career, particularly in the area of foreign direct investment and taxation, corporate taxation. You've been labelled the great architect of the double Irish tax scheme, rightly or wrongly. We'll come back to all of that. But I'm conscious of the fact, Fergal, and we're no relation, by the way, that it's only a few months since your mother, Mary O'Rourke, passed away. Yeah. That must have been a very hard time for you and for your family, albeit having had the benefit of her being with you for a very long time.
Yeah, and people ask me, did we miss her at Christmas? But I really missed her during the election, because during the election, she would have been on three times a day, you know, had I seen this interview or that interview, and she'd have been on the same to Angus between the two of us. And that's when it really came home to me, she was gone. And, you know, she had a great life. She lived life to the full, always did. And both Angus and I were chatting about it recently, and the funeral and the day before in the funeral home were amazing. Like, we were 4 hours in the funeral home the day before the funeral, and everybody had a story. Sometimes it was to do with politics. More often than not, it was just some human interaction. But plenty of people had said, your mother taught me English or history or Latin or French. And her bridesmaid from when she got married was there. So there was literally over the space of that 4 hours, her entire life, people walked by us and every one of them had a story of some description as to why they were there.
Your dad, Enda O'Rourke, died, I think, almost 25 years ago. It was a great shock. I mean, looking at the pictures in her own memoir, they're a beautiful couple. They're very handsome.
Yeah. Funny enough, Angus and I were clearing out the house recently at home in Athlone, and we came across a trove of photographs. And I brought some of them home to show to my own kids, and one or two of them there. They were married in 1960. So my mum would have been 23 and my dad would have been 25. And there was a few pictures of them when they were engaged in that. And they were a very striking couple. You don't think about that when your parents get older. But yeah, they were. And my dad was only 65 when he died. At the time, back in 2001, I thought, God, you know, it's old enough. Now that I'm just turned 60 myself, I'm thinking, God, it really was young. So my mum was widowed a long time.
A lot of people will know and remember her as a politician, yeah, as the public figure. What was she like as a mother, as a family person?
Ah, she was great. I mean, she was a wonderful cook. And we have a tiny, mum and dad built a house in Arcadia in Athlone, on the outskirts of Athlone in 1960. And that was the family home and still is the family home as such. A tiny kitchen, Sean, which would be half the size of this studio at best. She was a wonderful cook. She was a wonderful baker. You know, she used to make eclairs and meringues and stuff like that. So when we were kids having our birthday parties, it was a cornucopia of delights from that perspective. Mum and dad were fiercely loyal to myself and Angus. Now, you wouldn't get away with anything, far from it. But, you know, they would very much, family was really important. And they taught us the difference between right and wrong. And I, you know, I think if you know you're loved, if you get a good education and a good home upbringing, and you're taught the difference between right and wrong, you can't ask for much more, to be honest. And they were great parents, both my dad and you know, my dad is very much the quieter side of the family, but mum relied on him hugely, massively.
I have a memory of the early to mid 80s when I was a young political correspondent of the Irish Press in Dáil Éireann, and I think I used to see you coming in occasionally to the self-service yes, cafe, probably for a bit of grub and some money as well. The lure of politics must have been there for you.
Yeah, I mean, George W. Bush has a lovely phrase to explain his exuberance with alcohol. He says, when I was young and foolish, I was young and foolish. When I was young and foolish, I dabbled in politics, and I would have been very involved in Fianna Fáil and UCD and the Kevin Barry Common, and I was chair of that. And Beverly Flynn would have been the Common Secretary and Mary Coughlin would have been the Vice Chair. My cousins Connor and Brian in Trinity, Brian Jr., would have been very involved. And I was on the Fianna Fáil National Executive after I left college for a couple of years. So I think when you grow up in politics, and I mean, I remember at the time as well, there were a number of children of politicians who were involved. And I suppose it's understandable why you might get involved. You're living in this environment the whole time. So I've been very involved until I was 23, 24.
You must have had an opportunity to stand yourself for election.
Like I had, but I was very, very fortunate. I considered a very fortunate sliding doors moment. I was very low down the totem pole in PwC at the time. I just qualified as chartered accountant. I was doing my tax exams. Because you're on the national executive, you know, people were saying, well, like, you might want to consider running here or here. And a guy who's thankfully still alive, a good friend, Tom Grace, played for Ireland actually in rugby, a partner in PwC. He persuaded me that I had a future in PwC, that I could do really well in PwC. And it was a salutary lesson for me as I went through the organisation myself and led to run it, where, you know, a lot of times people in any organisation, they're not told how good they are or how well they are. And I often say to business leaders, you know, if somebody comes in to you to say they're leaving and you start telling them how great they are, shame on you. If they're leaving is the thing that forces you to tell them how good they are. And he saw something in me and he persuaded me to say, look, give up the old politics and focus on
business. Couldn't you have combined or maybe, you know, in and out, weaved your way through it?
If you want to be single-minded on something, Sean, no matter what it is, you've got to put all your efforts into it. And you could have done it. But when he told me that, I thought, look, I'll give the business a go. And that was 89. And 7 years later, I was 31. I was a partner. I was very young at that point to be a partner.
Yeah. Yeah, but you could have gone all the way in politics. You would certainly made cabinet, possibly leader, possibly Taoiseach.
But possibly lost my seat in an election then subsequently. So do I have any regrets? Absolutely none. But I'm not I think Mom was the same. I'm not a person who kind of looks back and say, oh, the road not taken. You make your decision. Maybe it's the right one, maybe it's the wrong, but you make your decision, you make your bed, you lie with it and you move on.
To what extent, or was it at all a factor, was the question of you were going to make far more money as an accountant?
Ah, no. I mean, you know, when you're young like that, it's not really about the money at that point. No, I was fortunate again in my PwC life. I had great mentors during my life. Like a really good mentor will be a good critical friend. They'll tell you what you're good at and how you can do better. But they'll also point out, look, if you need to work on this and you need to work on that. You've got to make sure, and I tried to do this during my own career, that when you leave behind you generations of people who you've mentored and brought along, who you know will then help lead the organisation for the next 20 or 30 years.
You had another important or critical friend, perhaps, in Martin McAleese during your time as PwC.
Yes, Martin was our chair of our oversight group. Martin is just a wonderful font of common sense and perspective. And, you know, what I loved about Martin, by the time I finished in PwC, I'd spent 37 years there to the day, boy and man, joined on the 8th of October 86, left on the 8th of October 2023. And to a certain extent, I was institutionalized. And Martin brought a brilliant perspective as chairman. You'd bounce a few things off him and you'd find that his perspective was entirely different from yours. And I mean this in a really positive way, because I was a product of my environment, and he just come in with a little different perspective. And then he was succeeded by Mark Ryan, who was great as well. Father James Ryan, actually, as well, though he's many other strings to his bow.
The rugby player.
I'm a big, you know, people talk a lot about diversity. I'm big into diversity, but I'm big into diversity of thought, because, you know, as an organisation, if you keep recruiting people, no matter what your organisation, with the same background, with the same degree, from the same place, you'll end up in the same way of thinking.
Would you have been strong in your leadership years, say, on the question of gender balance?
Ah, yeah. But you see, because I grew up where my mother had a bigger job than my dad, I never thought of it as anything. And I worked for women in my early years in PwC, so I never saw it as something different. In fact, recently, when Mum died, there was a photograph in the paper of the 89 cabinet. And that photograph's at home in her office, and I've seen it a million times. But when I looked at it again in 2024 and there was one woman and 15 men, I was saying, why did it not at the time hit me that she was the only woman? But that's the way cabinets looked in the 80s.
And they don't look a whole lot different now as we speak, do they?
It's waxed and waned a bit since then. But so in terms of diversity, yes, I was big in diversity, but diversity of thought, as well as gender, as well as sexual orientation, as well as nationality, as well as generational, diversity of actual thought. We go, people coming in with different mindsets and different disciplines and different backgrounds is massively important.
At what stage did politicians, I presume initially Fianna Fáil ones, start to draw on your expertise in accountancy and particularly in taxation?
If I look back now, I have had really engagements with ministers from all political spectrums. I suppose the first person really to pull me into the orbit was Charlie McCreevy. And I have huge time for Charlie. He was absolutely wonderful. And Charlie was one of those rare breed of politicians. He had absolute, we'd say, domain knowledge. He knew the area of finance. He was an accountant by training, knew tax and that. And he was a politician of convictions. And one thing about Charlie was, you know, if Charlie wanted to do something and the entire civil service was against him, he'd do it. And the opposite was also true. If Charlie didn't want to do it, he didn't want to do it. But I remember in opposition in that period, 94, 97, he kind of asked me, would I give him a handout and a few things? And I did. And then from there, you know, over the years, I'd have gone in and at request and talked to people like Michael Noonan or Enda Kenny or Pascal Donoghue or you know, Micheál or Jack Chambers or any of the rest of them. And I suppose I always played a straight bat. I see myself as apolitical. I think anybody who believes their party is always right is obviously wrong.
What was your relationship like with your cousin Brian Lennon when he was Minister for Finance? Was it the same as with other Ministers for Finance on that professional level?
Yeah, I mean, like you would have known Brian, as we called him. Brian would have canvassed views from everywhere. And I would have been one of those people where I've gone in. And I suppose you try and just give them the same advice as you give everybody. Look, here's the pluses, here's the minuses. And, as you reflect back, he was very selfless. At any time, even
he was absolutely heroic.
Well, like, it's relevant, but he would always be asking about you. And you'd say, how are you getting on? How are you doing? Mm-hmm. I'm fine. How are you getting on? You know, he always wanted to deflect it away from being about him. You know, I do think, and maybe it's psychological, I think... the role he had and the responsibility he felt, I think it kept him going. And when that was over, he went very quickly in the end. It wasn't that long after the election.
Probably less than 18 months.
Oh, yeah. And he was a really, really nice guy and a really good guy.
And did you have as good a working relationship with ministers on the Fine Gael or even Labour side as you did with Fianna Fáil?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I suppose what I brought to the table, I hope, was I understood the area of international tax and foreign direct investment exceptionally well, I hope. But also, I suppose, I understood their world. I understood their perspective on life. And, you know, politicians think differently sometimes to business people.
Did you have any sense, though, that there might have been a conflict of interest for you going into those situations? Because you were discussing matters which were obviously highly sensitive, pre-budget, perhaps in many instances, knowing full well that you had clients, Intel or whoever, who would have a vested interest in the kind of subjects that you were discussing with ministers.
Yeah, but the thing with, you've always got to be very open with politicians. And at the end of the day, I always say, advisors advise, ministers decide. But you'd always have to give both sides. And you'd also have to be very open about where you're coming from. The world knew I was involved in trying to attract companies into Ireland. But quite often there was a coincidence of interests. What was good for these companies was also good for Ireland. But you'd have to be very open and say, look, this is the benefit we'll have for these companies. This is the upside for Ireland. This is the potential downside. There it all is. You're the minister or you're the official and you decide.
One of the big controversial issues that arose, and I think it might have been part of that story, was the famous Apple tax fine, which it's brought in, 13 billion euro into the coffers of the Irish state. That was something that the Irish government resisted, and I think you might have been advising Apple in the appeal.
It wasn't actually, not personally. But no, I mean, the Apple case is one of those great historic legacy cases now. And for me, the issue was when the final judgment announced there recently, nobody was talking about Apple within 24 hours. They're all talking about how are we going to spend the 13 billion. So, I mean, the Irish position at the time was very straightforward. Europe said that Ireland had given unfair and illegal assistance to Apple and
perish the thought, which seems to be the view of the Irish government. We can't have this thrown at us.
And the state couldn't take that. But it's over now. And in fact, it ended, absent the 13 billion, which we get to spend, it ended with a whimper and not with a bang. It ended and moved on very quickly.
But reputationally, though, for Ireland, it bolstered the argument of those, and I know you do not accept it for one instance, that this was, and maybe remains to an extent, something of a tax haven.
It did at the time when the case originally arose back in 2013, 2014. And you also recall that that whole OECD process was kicking off, where there were the big countries after 100 years of pretty consistent international tax rules decided these rules don't suit us anymore, let's change them. So there was that whole maelstrom of the middle of the last decade about Ireland being a tax haven. But again, the world moves on very quickly. We're now compliant, we're an OECD compliant country. The world moves on very quickly.
But at the same time, you have people like the recently appointed Commerce Secretary in Donald Trump's administration, Howard Lutnick, Chair and CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald.
Who've big operations here.
Yes, saying that, look, it's a nonsense that Ireland operates a trade surplus at our expense. I know we're talking about something different now, but there is this, you know, something bordering on hostility to the way we do our business.
Crappy lie down. In the sense
of... Well, no, it's more crappy pay up.
Well, they're perhaps not inconsistent. I mean, Ireland has done exceptionally well over the last 25, 30 years in attracting foreign direct inward investment. And we've proved to be a very apt bridge between the US and Europe, being English speaking, being their nearest neighbour, etc., etc. And if you just take, the farm industry, which he was referring to when he talked about the trade surplus, Ireland has created a fantastic ecosystem for pharma companies here of the right expertise, the right regulation, and it's not surprising, and the right tax regime. And it's not surprising we've been successful. We've been nimble, we've been agile. And to put that in context, our nimbleness and our agileness, Sean, every year we've got a finance bill, and every year we change the tax law for individuals and for corporates. And every few years we say, we need to be a bit more nimble, a bit more agile around enterprise. The US changed their tax code in 2017. The previous time they changed their tax code was 1986. The US is not as nimble and as agile by virtue of its size as Ireland can be. So we have done very well. I think we're into this year, this calendar year 2025 will be a turbulent year. It'll be an interesting year. There's two forks in the road. Either at the end of the year, Europe and the US will be in an all-out trade war, or by the end of the year, some deal will have been done between Europe and the US that will allow us all to move on.
It's obvious which would you prefer, but I mean, which do you expect?
I'm an optimist by nature, so I remain hopeful that a deal will be done between Europe and the US over the course of this year.
Through your contacts with various Taoiseach, you've managed to be in the White House and in the Oval Office, I think on more than one occasion. For argument's sake, if you were in the White House, assuming the invitation comes through
St.
Patrick's weekend, what would you say to Donald Trump in terms of what could be best for the United States and best for Europe?
Well, it's not an occasion where you get to talk any great policy
details.
Well,
let's assume you do.
It's grip and grin, usually, when you're there. I think there must be a landing point where the US and Europe can claim victory. And I don't think it's in anybody's interests for that to escalate into a trade war. I think the president has made it very clear he wants more activities from US companies back in the US. So whether it's car manufacturing or pharmaceuticals or whatever. And it's not just possible to pick up manufacturing plants and walk back home with them. So I think if I was talking to the US administration, you'd be saying to them, look, there's got to be a way where your concerns can be addressed without actually ripping up the entire trade book out there. So I do remain hopeful that people will take the longer view and what's possible in the longer view, as opposed to what's just possible in the next 3 or 5, 6 months.
Wearing your chair of the IDA hat, for instance, everybody knows it's kind of a truism that what business hates is uncertainty. There's uncertainty there at the moment. So, I mean, how much more difficult has it become to promote foreign direct investment in Ireland, in the United States, in these circumstances? I mean, okay, you did very well last year and in recent years and over the decades, but what about now and into the future?
Well, you're a keen golfer, Sean. You play the ball as it lies. And, our ball...
I wish I could sometimes.
So, I think it got to a point, though, as you talk to these major companies, they're not going to have all their activities in the US. For global organisations, it just doesn't make sense. And, I think Americans in the system recognises that if you're a global player, US player, you will have operations around the world. Europe is a massive market. So has it impacted? Yes, I mean, there is uncertainty. And I think what we're finding now, this is not just Ireland, this is globally. I think US companies are just pausing at the moment just to see how the next few months play out.
Would you be expecting, or can we take it that there will be fewer instances of companies deciding to invest in Ireland in this year?
The The pipeline is still very good. I mean, we ended 2024 with a fraction over 302,000 people directly employed by foreign direct investment companies, a substantial portion which are US. That's the third year running that that's happened. Now, to put that in context, 10 years ago, that figure was 200,000. So there's been a massive increase in foreign direct investment employment over the last 10 years. And roughly, and it varies by 1 or 2 percentage points, but not by much, about 2/3 every year of investment into Ireland from existing companies here who say, Ireland really works. We're going to put it on the map, on a roadmap back at headquarters for the next investment, the next investment. And we've had some stellar announcements over the last few months by companies like IBM and Microsoft and companies like that. So while there is uncertainty, I would see still, I suppose the optimist in me says we'll get through it. But I'll be honest, if you were saying to me now, at the end of calendar 25, we'll still have more than 300,000 people directly employed by foreign direct investment companies. We'll still be collecting about 30 billion in tax, and we'll have avoided, the EU will have avoided a trade war with the US. I'd grab it and run.
Are President Trump's plans and the uncertainty and upheaval that he has created or provoked, are they your biggest concern for Ireland, or are there other concerns? Maybe, I think, as the previous Managing Director of ID Ireland, Martin Shanahan, wrote recently in the Irish Times, look, worry about what we can control and address those things, be it infrastructure or housing or whatever.
Yeah, the IDA is on the cusp now of rolling out her new strategy now that the government is back. And we started this process about a year ago, long before President Trump was back in the Oval Office. And it was interesting because, you know, foreign direct investment is slowing globally around the world. You've got the threat of artificial intelligence, of increased digitization, of countries coming on the scene who weren't active before in foreign direct investment, like Saudi Arabia or the UAE offering money, etc., etc. But the more the board and the executives dug into our strategy formulation, I see the biggest threats are the single biggest threat, as I would see it, to our success over the next 5 years is execution risk, as I call it. Can we execute on the plans we have around housing, water, grid, renewable energy? These are societal issues as well as economic issues, but there are great plans in place around offshore energy, around the grid, around water, around housing. If we can execute on those, we could be entering into another golden era for inward investment. If we don't execute on those, the road could be bumpy because we're dealing with problems of success now.
Your uncle, you're echoing something that the late Brian Lenihan Sr. used to say, our problems are the problems of success. and he was a great man with phrases and words. But is there any case or point that would it work where we actually might just go easy a little bit on trying to attract more people in, more investment, until we get a chance to catch our breath and build a few more houses? And, like, I mean, the notion of a three-bed semi, second-hand, costing 700,000 euro for a young couple, you know, anywhere inside the M50. I mean, it's going to take a long time to fix that. And maybe we just ease off a little bit.
Yeah, and that's a valid question. And it's one that the board considered when we were formulating the strategy. Should we just ease back? Should we not try to be the best industrial development agency in the world? Our society is going to change massively over the next number of years with the growing population we have, with the investment we need to make in housing and all the other areas we discussed, with the decarbonisation that's going to have to take place. That's going to have to be paid for. And right now, it's effectively been paid for by the 30 billion corporate tax we're taking. So personally, I don't believe it's an either or. I don't believe it says, let's stop foreign direct investment coming in until we solve our own problems. I think we've got to do both. I think we've got, because don't forget.
But even slowing the pace?
But you see, Sean, like, you can't slow the pace in the sense of every year we measure our gross job announcements, but there's also net, there's losses. And sometimes those losses are general economy. Sometimes they're sectoral. Sometimes they're company specific. So we have no way of knowing at the start of any year how many jobs are going to lose before. So we know in any year we're going to be down X number of jobs before we gain them in. It's like not committing to your golf shot, Sean. If you think, I don't need to fully commit to this shot, what's going to happen? You're going to make a hames of it. Right?
Yeah, but look at what's happened and what's been evidenced in the last few weeks. We have, you know, almost a stampede of high-tech bosses cozying up to Trump. I mean, and he's happy to take them in, like Elon Musk being the most famous or notorious, depending on your point of view, and other high-tech companies. And maybe that's just something that's going to work its way down the line. And we mightn't actually get the kind of interest we would hope for or have previously enjoyed.
Exactly. You know, it's not a game in which we can ever rest on our laurels. And interestingly, the Tánaiste has indicated, you know, we need to be upping our game in the US and is talking about the formation of a sort of an advisory committee. I think it's a good time for Ireland to sort of say, OK, you know, what influence do we have in Brussels, for example? What influence do we have in Wall Street? What about Congress in Capitol Hill? What about on K Street? So I think the Tánaiste has identified that we probably need to reset our influence game in a world that's infinitely more.
I know, but if you look at somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Meta and Facebook, and changing the rules of his game to allow for more free speech, as he would have it, and to, again, cozy up to Trump. I mean, how secure or how confident can we be that the operation they have in Ireland or the operations will stay as healthy as they are?
Well, you mentioned Facebook. You look at Anne O'Leary, who's the head of Facebook in Ireland, a good Cork woman, and no better woman to go out there and bang the table looking for more for Ireland. And that's, Sean, is I wouldn't underestimate the point of that. One of Ireland's massive successes is that in most, nearly all cases, the people who run the operations of these US companies in Ireland are really good, really smart, really good at understanding, at first of all, creating relationships back at headquarters, then working out, OK, where's the next big investment coming over the next couple of years? And how do I get Ireland best placed for that? So a lot of credit's given to the IDA, a lot of credit is given to the government in this for attracting investment. Never enough credit is given to the Irish leadership of these organisations who are brilliant back at headquarters.
Is it possible, though, that the boardrooms that they walk into and make those cases, as you say, they might be a little bit colder as boardrooms for the Irish input? I'm thinking particularly of something else. The whole question and the controversy over our attitude to Israel, joining in the case with South Africa to have them brought before the International Court, the Occupied Territories Bill, plus the statements by the President, which have generated a lot of controversy. I mean, for instance, I just happened to tap onto the website of the Jewish Chronicle after Michael D. Higgins' speech at the anniversary of the Holocaust. There were three substantial articles excoriating the president for his views, as outlined, even the mention of Gaza. Now, we won't get into a debate about, you know, the imbalance between the sides there, but that's the sort of stuff that seeps right through a community, a people of the Jewish faith, and they are very prominent, as we know, in US politics and business.
Well, as chairman of the IDA, I have no view on that in the sense of we have to play the ball as it lies, we have to play the hand we're given. I will say, I knew this in my past life in PwC, and I see it now. Companies love Ireland. They do well in Ireland. Ireland does well for them. But it's very economic orientated, and you've got to keep producing and keep producing. So the idea that companies are here because they love Ireland and they'll always love Ireland, and you know, it's not. It is, and transactional is much too strong a word, but it's economic driven. If there comes a point where Ireland, in their perspective, isn't paying its way or it doesn't make sense to be here, they're not going to stay out of any misguided loyalty. So politics and all this and all the surrounding sound around it, yeah, it's important. But in my professional life, it really comes down to economics.
But how big a problem is it for you and others in the IDA, in their offices, and indeed the Irish diplomats, to have to deal with or to contend with maybe the headwind that's caused by things like the President's remarks or the Occupied Territories Bill?
To be honest, Sean, having met a number of clients over recent months, it's not the first thing they will always talk about.
Is it there, though?
I can genuinely say, if it has come up, it's been very much at the peripheral of, talk to me about what Ireland's going to do about the grid, about water, about offshore renewables, about housing. They're the bread and butter issues that companies want to see get fixed in Ireland or make sure are operating at maximum efficiency. That's what makes their profit or loss.
I mean, is it a problem that, you know, we were misled into thinking or believing that there were going to be 40,000 new homes built in this country in 2024? Turns out it was much closer to 30,000.
Yeah, IDA's job, funny enough, is not to build houses, but our job is to amplify the message back to the government that this isn't...
So you could be accused of mis-selling then.
Well, it's not an economic issue. This is a social issue. This is a societal issue in the first instance. But our job is to keep reflecting back and amplifying to the government what are the issues that are coming to us on the business doorsteps when companies talk about Ireland. And they are about, you know, grid, offshore energy, et cetera, et cetera. There's, as I mentioned, coming back to where I started this point, execution risk now is our biggest risk over the next 5 years, more so than the external environment. We've got to, you know, there's great plans for grid, for offshore energy, for water, for housing. We've got to actually execute on them now.
Do you see enough in the programme for government as published recently to make sure those objectives are achieved?
I'm an optimist by nature. The money is there. I don't think the money is an issue. The plans are there. Now we've got to make it happen. And there's no elections or other distractions for the next 3 or 4 years. I'm hopeful that the government will execute now on all these and get them done.
You've observed through adulthood and from your early adulthood to your, well, partial retirement, let's call it, in your 60th year or thereabouts, a lot of change in politics. At this stage, do you see much difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael?
I think Ireland is fortunate in that the political spectrum isn't as wide as in other countries. And I think, broadly speaking, if you look historically, we probably avoided the class distinction that other countries may have, that may have given rise to political divisions and parties and others. So it gives me comfort that there's no radical differences on between any of the parties on the importance of enterprise, domestic enterprise and foreign direct investment. You don't really see a massive difference between that.
Would you have been comfortable, for instance, with Sinn Féin forming part of the government instead of the current arrangement or the previous arrangement continuing?
Oh, as chairman of IDA, I would have been happy with anybody who formed a government. It's again, our job is whoever's in government, we are an arm of...
Were you consulted, for instance, by Sinn Féin in the development of their policies coming up to the last election?
In my past life, I would have met with all political parties and given them my tuppence worth. It would have been a bit of a stretch to say I didn't put it into their thing. But I've been very open with my views on corporate tax, for example, and the importance of inward investment to anybody who'd give me the time of day to listen to me.
You were saying at the outset that one of the things you brought was a sense of how politicians thought, and obviously that was their, you know, sort of with your mother's milk, as it were, from your childhood onwards. Did some of those political instincts that you would have acquired and developed and grown up with, how helpful would those have been, say, in your own work internally? I mean, there's always office politics. I mean, what about in PwC?
I suppose when I was running for managing partner, it's unusual in a corporate sense, it was an election. And I was running against two excellent other candidates, Andy and John and myself. And we had to go around to the then 98 partners and pitch the case to them as to why you were the right man to lead the organisation for the next 4 years. And the managing partner had all the powers of a benign dictator, including allocation of income and all the other things that go with it. So I suppose I understood. I tell the story, you know, when the three of us met afterwards and the culture of the organisation, wonderful. Once the election was over, everybody rode in again. But that night, the three of us were chatting and one of them said to me, did you think you'd win it on the first count? And I opened my wallet and I took out a bit of paper. I said, I'm one vote out, but I think I know where it is. And they couldn't get over this. And I kind of said to them, look, you know, if a partner would say to me, Fergal, you're absolutely brilliant. You're the best tax person in Dublin for the last 40 years. You're brilliant with people. You're great on your feet. You're wonderful. I wish you the best of luck as managing partner. That's a no.
that sounds like something you'd hear from people on the Senate campaign. That's a no. Why?
When I was running, I'd always finish by looking the person in the eye and say, can I count on your vote? And I mean, that's something that would have been drummed into us from, as you say, when we're having the breakfast. My grandfather, Paddy Lennon, was in business, went late in life into politics. And he won the seat in 1965, beating General Sean McKeown in the famous long count that went on for the best part of a week. And he won it by, I think it was 6 votes in the end. So we were brought up, you know, you never leave without asking for the vote. And it was really important. And, you know, there would be some people who'd look you in the eye and say, look, I've known Andy or John all my life and I'm voting for them. But best luck. And that's fine. There's some people say you don't have to worry about me. For me, the biggest compliment was that when 4 years later, I came up for re-election Nobody ran against me, but you still have to have a confirmatory vote. And I remember Mum saying to me, how do you think it'll go? And I said, I think there'll be a 90% turnout, and I'd be hopeful. I've broken a few eggs, but hopefully 90% positive. I got 100% turnout, and in a secret ballot got 100% positive vote. Now, my mother was very sceptical. She said, they mustn't have thought it was a secret ballot. And I said, Mum, they just, you know, tick the box and put it into a box. But for me, I think it was affirmation. I tried in my leadership style to be very upfront with people and not to obfuscate, and, you know, where there were tough things to be said, I'd say them in an empathic and respectful way. But
and staying with your family, Fergal, I mean, politics had its ups and downs. You know, your Uncle Brian lost his seat in Roscommon.
Yeah, I remember that. I was eight or nine. I remember well that
1973,
night.
1973, I think that was, yeah. And then your mother lost her seat, and also she kind of got pushed around the place by people like Albert, who she describes in great detail in her memoir, Just Mary. And also, Bertie didn't do any favours by, well, claiming, as she would have said, that there was a third out of four seats to be got for Fianna Fáil. It was a 2002 election.
Yeah.
And she came out the wrong end of that.
Ah, time heals all wounds, Sean. And in fairness, I will say to Bertie, he was exceptionally good when Mum was in the nursing home the last couple of years. He was a regular visitor. And one thing I think I've inherited from Mum, and I think my uncle was probably the same, is Mum was very fond of using the final line of Gone with the Wind, which is, tomorrow's another day. And I always remember when Albert fired her in 91. I remember talking to her about it, and she was devastated, and she went home that night. And I remember saying, she woke up the next morning and she wanted just to pull the duvet over her head and say, I'm having a duvet day. And she said, no, I've got to get up and put on the makeup and put your best face on and go out and smile. And that's what she did. And that's what she did in good times and bad times. She put her best foot forward. She also, and I very much believe this myself, I have a real belief in things happen for a reason, and it'll play out the way it's meant to play out. And, you know, there was a bit of an approach at the time. She'd go off to Europe and she'd be getting a vice presidency of whatever. I said, I'll hang around. And 3 years later, she was deputy leader. So I do believe myself, and even times when I've had my own kind of things that have gone backwards, you kind of say to yourself, look, put your best foot forward and it'll work out. You know, it's meant to be, and it'll play out the way it's meant to play out.
And an even bigger crisis or setback was obviously the loss of your dad in 2001. I mean, that was far deeper and far more difficult than any political setback.
Yeah. And I think she dealt with it in part by talking about him a lot. Mm. Any chance she got to talk about him, she would. And that kind of kept him alive for her. Mm. And that was tough on her. And I think for a good while after he died, she was kind of a bit lost. And
she missed him particularly in that 2002 election.
Oh, yeah, because Dad would have manned the home fires and kept the home fires burning. And yeah, I think in part there was that. And also, Mum would listen to Dad. I mean, she'd rant away about something and he'd be quiet, and then he'd say, well, I think this or I think that. And she would have put huge store in his advice. There's no doubt that, you know, as well as the ill-judged strategy at the time, Dad's loss had a huge... It just took a lot out of her. Now, as I say, she came back. She had a third career effectively then when she quit politics in 2011 and started writing. Her positivity and her optimism and her just, you get on with it and you don't wallow, even though it hurt her. Right, she didn't ostensibly wallow in it. She tried to put her best foot forward. She talked about that a lot. I know it inside. Mm. It took a lot from her.
Yeah, you know? And of course, you know, the firing of her brother Brian in the middle of that presidential campaign. I mean, like, you do have to be terribly strong to keep going in those circumstances.
Yeah, you do. I mean, the 1990 campaign, it seems like 100 years ago now.
It is
sense.
About 35.
Well, it's 35 years ago. But I always remember, it's you know, again, when you think about your memories of growing up, I would have been, 25 at the time. There was an event down in Athlone for Brian, obviously where he had grown up and gone to school. And this was around the time that P. Flynn was sent down to actually get him to resign. And it was almost Parnellite in its sort of the setting. It's night, it's the Prince of Wales Hotel, it's a winter's night. They're lined up all the way down the corridor to the ballroom. There have been people who Brian would have grown up with, people, they were all lying down there. Connor is about 10 yards ahead shouting, no resignation, no resignation. The crowd are taking this up. Brian Senior is walking down this. They're all like, you're short just the sort of fire lit, kerosene soaked lamps. P. Flynn couldn't get near Brian, and I look back now, and it is Parnellite. It must have been like the fall of Parnell, like this whole thing. And I'm not sure any book or any film has really captured that whole time. It was fascinating. And yet time moves on. I remember talking to Mary Harney about it years later, and she kind of regretted a bit of how it had all played out, because Brian was a thoroughly decent person and was completely demonized for those 3 weeks. But that's politics.
There must be a part of you which says, Fergal, you'd have done well as Taoiseach.
I have a huge regard, as I said, for anybody who goes into politics. Look, it was a fork in the road at a period of time. I took it.
It's not too late, by the way.
No,
I mean,
it is.
Donald Trump is 78. Joe Biden was 82.
Yeah.
That's two decades away.
My wife would leave me. Maeve would not have it.
Really?
But it's also a younger person's game, Sean. I have no interest in doing it. I genuinely don't. In PwC, I realised all my professional dreams. I travelled the world. I got well paid. I worked with brilliant companies, brilliant people. I had a ball. I did different roles my time there. If you'd offered it all to my 21-year-old self when I was starting off, I would have said, where do I sign my life away? Where is my soul away?
Well, to an extent, you're still travelling the world, aren't
you? I know, I travel
lots. But all of the luxuries that go with, you know, sort of executive travel and all that kind of
thing. Oh, no, it's funny. When I was, I went to New York and Washington in Patrick's Day with the IDA, and the company secretary came in to me a few weeks before, and he said, and he was kind of shuffling a bit, and he said, Chairman, do you want to travel business class to New York? And I said, I have travelled business class in my entire professional career, but do I want to see the headline on the Irish Times of IDA chairman's X thousand? No, thank you. I'll pass. So, but, you know, at the end of the day,
doesn't that suggest to you there's a certain pettiness? I mean, people knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing. You arrive in a better condition to do negotiations, to make presentations.
It doesn't bother me at all. And to be honest, I feel privileged to be the chair of the IDA. It is an incredible organisation in the sense of, you know, when I was appointed chair, somebody said, you know, how many people are in the IDA? And I said, well, how many do you think? Because when I was preparing for it, I thought there must be about 700 people here. There's less than 400, fewer than 400 people in the IDA. There are people in there who I have no doubt could earn more in the private sector, but they have, and I use the word, they have a patriotism, a wanting to do the best they can for Ireland. And it is phenomenal when you see it. I genuinely feel privileged to be the chair, to lead such a wonderful organisation at board level.
Talk to me about rugby. You played it as a youngster along with other
not
sports.
Not very well.
You've got this huge new tome about Irish rugby in the professional era.
Yeah, one of my post-PwC bucket list things to do. I've always been interested in rugby, and Dad was secretary of the local club for 20-odd years and then was president. And I was always interested in rugby. A few years back, I just noticed there was lots of errors in match reports and stuff. I said, started keeping my own records. Anyway, long story short, when I finished with PwC, I decided I was going to have this book produced, From Rags to Riches. It's a tome, as you say. It covers the 29 seasons since the game went professional, all the 316 test matches that Ireland have played. It's nearly sold out, actually. There's a few copies still left in Elvries, but all the profits are going to the IRFU Charitable Trust, which looks after seriously injured players. I'm delighted to have done it. It's and I write the articles for the match programme for the last 7 or 8 years, the Irish home programmes. I do that, and I'm involved in some committees in the IRFU. So it's kind of one of those pastime things. I'm delighted to be involved with the Irish Rugby Football Union, and particularly on their 150th anniversary this year.
We're having this conversation shortly after Ireland defeated England at the Aviva in Lansdowne Road. I'd just like your comment on one of the reports that was in the Sunday Times talking about Ireland.
Is this Stephen Jones now?
They thrived on the needle sharp incisiveness of Jemison Gibson Park at scrum half, James Lowe on the wing, Mac Hansen on the other wing, Bundy Aki in midfield, and they were also well served by the odd Irish born player. Discuss.
Oh, the salty tears.
But is there a point there that, I mean, there are really good and talented Irish-born players who grew up in, be it Munster or Connacht or Ulster or Leinster, being kept out of the highest level, of playing at the highest level by imports.
Yeah, but if you look at, say, last year in Durban, where I was fortunate to be, where we had neither Gibson Park nor Aki, and we still beat the world champions in their backyard. They're great players, wonderful servants for Ireland. And it's the end of a particular period of international rugby, where, as you know, there was a period, if you spent 3 years in a country and you hadn't played previously, you could qualify for that country. That's now 5 years. So they're the last three players, funny enough, of what were called project players who came over. And to be honest, I don't think anybody walking out of the Aviva Stadium would have been saying, "It might have been better if those three players hadn't been playing."
Absolutely.
They've been taken
to the hearts of the Irish sporting
Absolutely.
Public in much the same way as Jack Charlton was back in the day, and a lot of the people who played for him as well. The book, obviously, part of your bucket list items. Yeah. What else is there?
I don't know, actually. Sorry, that was one of the key ones for calendar 24 to get done. I'm fortunate in that I'm involved in a couple of organisations. I'm chairing the IDA. I'm chairing Brendan Halligan's old think tank, the Institute for International and European Affairs, the IIEA, which is really interesting. Alex White is the Director General there. I'm on the board of an energy company. I'm on the board of a drinks company. I'll think of things now I need to do over the next 2 or 3 years, but politics isn't one of them.
Okay, well, thank you.
To be sure.
If a Senate seat was offered to you now at the Taoiseach, would you be inclined to say yes? You couldn't refuse the Taoiseach, could you?
But it's incompatible with my role as chairman of IDF, which I absolutely love.
Well, that's not going to happen. Fergal O'Rourke, an absolute pleasure to listen to your observations and your insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sean.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.